Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources, and we're going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine, and this is from Real People, and this one is Memory Keeper. My daughter's spirit is in Arlington. This is honoring our veterans. Gold Star mother Joyce Richmond's pays annual tribute to fallen soldiers. And we have a picture here of her at the Veterans Memorial Park in Lewiston, Maine. And she has on a jacket and jeans and is holding a wreath with a red bow in front of a grave with the sign Golden Star Mothers. When my daughter, Denise Mikolajic, joined the Air Force in 1982, I wasn't terribly surprised. She never relied on anybody to push her to get into things. She had her own ideas. Denise started as a mechanic repairing pneumatics and hydraulics for huge C-130 transport planes. She was the only woman on her team, and people gave her crap for it. But she persevered, and she did very well. Everybody loved her. After she got pregnant with her second child, she figured she'd better get off the tarmac. She took a job organizing personnel for missions, becoming Chief Master Sergeant Mikolajic. During her 26 years in the military, Denise was deployed all over the world. But she died in a restaurant on the way to an Air Force base in Omaha, Nebraska in 2009. There had been a benign tumor in a chamber in her heart, and it blocked a microvalve. One comfort to me is that she never knew what hit her. Still, it was devastating. She was on active duty when she died, and that made me a Gold Star mother. That year, I read about the organization Wreaths Across America, which arranges for volunteers to lay wreaths on military graves every December. I saw a photo of all the wreaths at Arlington National Cemetery, and that piqued my curiosity. In December of 2016, I went on my first convoy and traveled from Columbia Falls, Maine, to Arlington, Virginia. I've done it every year since, even during the pandemic. The date this year is December 18th. It's not just about getting off a bus and laying down a wreath on a stone. They say somebody dies twice, when it happens and when nobody says your name anymore. So we say the names and take a minute to reflect. Even carrying the wreath is a very personal thing. Though Denise is buried near my home in Maine, her spirit is in Arlington, and I hope somebody is putting a wreath on her grave and honoring her that day. A big hunk of something leaves you when your child dies, but my grief is not an aching hole anymore. I think Wreaths Across America has helped. Being a part of it makes me feel prouder of Denise. Every time I get a chance to talk about her, I feel prouder. This article was as told to Mara Reinstein. Joyce Richmond, 81, of Lewiston, Maine, is a retired business administrator. For information about volunteering for Wreaths Across America, visit wreathsacrossamerica.org. Our next person, a courageous leader, and we're still honoring our vets. His valor recognized 70 years later. Veteran Army Ranger Ralph Puckett gets his due with a little support from the Commander-in-Chief. Retired Army Colonel Ralph Puckett, Jr., 94, is a highly decorated veteran of both the Korean and Vietnam Wars. When the Korean War started in 1950, I was as green as you could get. I graduated from West Point the year before. My Ranger company arrived in Korea shortly after the war started. 2 months after we got there, we took Hill 205 in what is now North Korea, about 60 miles south of the border with China. By that point, we knew we were fighting not only North Korean troops, but Chinese forces who had come across the border. It was a very frigid night, and the Chinese troops below us kept arriving until we were outnumbered by 4 or 5 to 1. They hit us with mortars, hand grenades, and machine guns. Over the following hours, we repulsed 5 waves of Chinese troops trying to retake the hill, but we lost troops with each assault. I was wounded several times, including in both of my feet. The 6th wave forced us few survivors off the hill, and I told my men to leave me behind so they could get to safety. "We're not leaving you, sir," one replied. A ranger put me over his shoulder and staggered down the mountain. When he couldn't go any further, others grabbed my wrists and dragged me. I received a Distinguished Service Cross for that battle, and that was the end of the story until more than 50 years later, when a retired ranger named John Locke read about the battle while researching a book. He thought I should have earned a Medal of Honor, the country's highest military honor, and he pursued that goal for 18 years. There were times when I wasn't sure whether it was worth pursuing, but when I was finally awarded the Medal of Honor at the White House in May, I couldn't believe this was happening to me. My Rangers were the ones who did the work. Unfortunately, I'm a little unsteady on my feet these days, and during the White House ceremony, I started weaving. So I leaned over on President Biden. "Just lean all you want," he whispered. "I would like to close the gap between the military and the civilian worlds. Unless someone has a loved one who's seen combat, they may not really understand the commitment of the people who serve. Over the years, I've met countless Army Rangers. They're all just as eager and devoted as we were on that cold Korean hilltop." And this was told to Brennan Jensen. And there's one more profile in this story. Sources of strength. Honoring our vets. Aiding vets' families helped heal my hurt. When Robin Kelher organized an event to support a friend, she started a chain reaction. "My father served in the Army. He did 3 tours in Vietnam, then served in Spain and in Germany. So he was gone a lot, and I blamed him for that. In 2002, I married a Marine and moved to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. My husband immediately deployed to Iraq. Again, I had a feeling of isolation. In 2004, a close family friend suffered a traumatic brain injury while serving in Iraq, and I wanted to do something to help families struggling with injury and loss and to ensure that military families knew they had someone to rely on. I'm a runner, so we decided to organize a run for the community to show its support for military families. That first year, 2006, we had 2,000 people show up, even though it was pouring rain. After the event, we knew we should do more, so we founded a nonprofit, Hope for the Warriors, which provides financial, mental, and physical wellness programs, as well as educational, recreational, and transition opportunities. Founded in North Carolina, the nonprofit has grown to a staff of 57 and has served more than 36,000 service members. The more I got to know other deployed families, the more I saw how they struggled. The divorce rate is so high. Unfortunately, my own marriage wasn't immune. My husband and I were divorced in 2013. It wasn't easy, but I had my family, work, and my community. Spending time helping others helped me to heal. My own experiences also gave me a completely different perspective on my dad and his service. It became very clear that I had to rethink some of the things I had believed while growing up. I was able to let go of the anger and reconnect with him. These days, my dad is my biggest supporter, and I've discovered that we have a lot in common. He has a tremendous sense of adventure, even well into his 80s, and I know he is proud of the work that I'm doing. So this was by Robin Keller, 56, of Annandale, Virginia. She was a 2021 AARP Purpose Prize Fellow, and she told this story to Andrea Atkins. Now let's talk about heart-healthy diets from the Centennial Living Complete Guide to Heart Health for folks over 50. You should replace saturated fat with healthy fats, not junk carbs or sugar. A little healthy fat boosts nutrient absorption in veggies. And there's some wonderful pictures here of food and grains. Based on these beneficial components of the Mediterranean and DASH diets, it's no surprise that plant-based diets may also be good for the heart. In a study of more than 12,000 adults published in the Journal of the American Heart Association in 2019, people whose diets were highest in plants and lowest in animal foods had a lower risk of dying from cardiovascular disease or any cause compared to those eating more animals and fewer plants. But no matter which diet you try, the key is to stick to the program as closely as possible. A lot of times, people handpick what works for them from a diet, Rothenstein says. But if you're not following certain principles, you won't see most of the benefits. Deciding to eat more fish and beans while still downing red meat and lots of refined grains doesn't give you all the perks of following the Mediterranean diet. The same goes for eating a lot of processed foods, like vegan cheese and cookies, rather than eating predominantly whole foods, not packaged and processed. According to a 2017 study in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, diets rich in healthier plant-based foods lower the risk of coronary heart disease, while those higher in less healthy plants increase the risk. When it comes down to it, though, any healthy change you make are better than none at all. Diets that make your heart sad. What about low-carb diets and heart health? These days, the ketogenic diet, which emphasizes fat, is all the rage. And many other carb-restrictive plans like Atkins, South Beach, and Dukin are also popular. While they can be a good way to lose weight for some people, their higher protein and fat content are not so great for your heart. A 2005 study of 164 adults published in the Journal of the American Medical Association found that replacing carbs with protein or monounsaturated fat appeared to lower blood pressure and improve cholesterol levels. However, since then, other research found an association between high intakes of protein from animal or plant sources and an increased risk of heart failure in middle-aged and older men. Excessive protein, more than 40% of your total daily calories, appears to promote the development of atherosclerosis, according to a study published in Nature Metabolism in 2020. But protein may not be the only culprit, since some low-carb diets, like keto, emphasize fat. In a study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association in 2019, researchers analyzed the health records of almost 14,000 adults over more than two decades. They found that people who followed low-carb diets, whether they replaced their carbs with protein or fat, had an increased risk of a type of irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation, compared to those eating a moderate or high amount of carbs. The study's authors believe this risk may be due to a reduced intake of anti-inflammatory vegetables, fruits, and grains, increased oxidative stress from the extra protein and fat, and or an increased risk of other forms of cardiovascular disease that contribute to atrial fibrillation. Although more research is necessary, especially on the long-term effects of these diets, most cardiologists discourage a low-carb diet. The people in the study on atrial fibrillation ate less than 44% of their calories from carbs. Some of my clients who come to see me after they have gone on the ketogenic diet present with extremely high cholesterol levels, Rothenstein says. If you eat a very low-carb and high-protein diet, you're likely to be deficient in fiber, which can be detrimental to your gut and to your heart. The one upside of low-carb diets? They typically cut out added sugars. Excess sugar intake can increase weight gain and also blood pressure levels, which can cause inflammation in the blood vessels and lead to atherosclerosis, Ruthenstein says. The AHA recommends women consume no more than 100 calories from added sugars, about 6 teaspoons or 25 grams of sugar, a day. For men, stick to more than 150 calories, about 9 teaspoons or 36 grams. Now, our next article in Prevention, Find Your Calm, is how to practice meditation. Learning how to meditate effectively can take time, but the benefits are plentiful. Here, some expert advice on getting started. Meditation can take many forms, whether that's a breathing exercise, use of a mantra, or a guided visualization, Smiley says. Mindfulness meditation can also be incorporated into your daily routine, such as your morning shower or a coffee break. For beginners, I recommend they start practicing a meditation through a breathing exercise. How to do it? Get yourself to a comfortable place. It's ideal to find an area without distractions so you can concentrate on your breath and harnessing meditation's restorative powers. But you can meditate in a chair or on the floor, lying down or even standing up or walking. Once you have found your spot, center yourself with a few deep breaths. As you inhale and exhale deeply, silently say in and out with each breath. During this cycle, if a thought comes into the mind, gently and non-judgmentally acknowledge it, let it go, and return to the breath. You don't need a marathon meditation session to reap its rewards. Research shows that even 10-minute sessions can improve focus, memory, and train your brain to better cope with everyday life. And don't stress about being good at it. You can't mess up meditation, and you can't banish all thoughts from your mind. That's okay, too. When you get distracted or feel your thoughts wandering, simply acknowledge it and actively shift the focus back to your body and your breath. And so this is an article or a little section about This Is Your Body on Meditation. A regular practice can calm your brain, help your heart, and yes, make you a better person. Your brain. Just 8 weeks of meditation lowers activity in the right amygdala, which is linked with a better stress response. Skin. Psoriasis is often exacerbated by stress, which may explain why meditation can improve it. Your joints. Long-time meditators showed a reduced expression of two types of genes linked to inflammation. Your mind. Meditating engages neural systems in the brain associated with empathy. Your heart. You may be able to lower blood pressure with twice daily sessions of transcendental meditation. And finally, your stomach. Meditation can lower the stress hormone cortisol, helping decrease belly fat. And now I'm going to begin on an article from AARP, the magazine. It's a very long article with various sections. Cold Case Stories, The Man Who Brings Back the Dead. While acting as his mother's caregiver, an unassuming accountant stumbled on his life's true passion, solving America's most puzzling missing persons cases. There's a picture of him, Carl Koppelman, at his desk in Torrance, California. With off-the-shelf design software and native talent, he creates realistic portraits of unidentified remains. preface, A River of Souls. Death is not, in fact, the end of the story. From the point of view of biology, it's simply another chapter. The body continues to change, sometimes rendering a person unrecognizable, even to loved ones. Open-air exposure can reduce human remains to a skeleton in a matter of weeks. Fire may shrink a person's bones. And the fast-flowing river offers its own catalog of cruelties to the flesh. Which is why, in June 2016, Elizabeth Nelson had a problem. An investigator in the Spokane County, Washington Medical Examiner's Office at the time, Nelson was in the morgue looking down at the body of a man whom authorities had retrieved from a log jam in the Spokane River. He appeared to have been dead for at least 2 weeks, and that time in the water had radically altered the shape of his face, lips, and eyes. A tall, bald man with a long gray beard, he carried no wallet and offered few clues as to his identity. Even if this were your family member, you wouldn't have recognized him, Nelson told me. Nelson sees each unidentified body as a problem, both practical and existential. Without a name, she couldn't inform the man's family of his death or return his remains, and the police would have a tough time investigating foul play. But there is also the question of dignity. A name is the very least that should accompany the dead when they are put to rest. So the investigator went to Facebook and messaged the one person she thought could make this death man look as he had in life. Carl Koppelman, a 50-something accountant, then living in El Segundo, California, in the suburban house where he lovingly cared for his ailing mother. Carl, this is Elizabeth from the Spokane ME's office, she wrote. She left certain things unsaid. As usual, she was hoping for a fast turnaround. As usual, she could not pay. Send me the photos, Koppelman replied. Koppelman is not a detective or forensic anthropologist. He does not work for a government agency or a university, and is technically an amateur, being largely self-taught and a solo operator working for free at the asking. Yet, he has gained a reputation among detectives, medical examiners, and fellow sleuths for his portraits of the dead. Unlike police sketches, Koppelman's portraits have a soulfulness to the eyes and a vivacity to the features, so that whatever death has done to the people they portray, even if it has reduced them to skeletons, he can make them look alive. His portraits had solved cases before, and Nelson, who knew his skills to be phenomenal, was hoping he could work his magic again. But when he sat down at his weathered oak desk and opened the images on his monitor, Koppelman quickly realized his drowned man's face was going to be one of the hardest he had ever worked on. Adept at tamping down fear and revulsion, after years at his evocation, he studied the images the way a grandmaster studies a chessboard. What moves had death and the river made? How might he counter them? Using a software called Coral Photo Paint, he smoothed out the man's complexion, filled in his beard, and thinned his cheeks and lips. The finished portrait depicted a man with a glint in his eyes and a slight, thoughtful smile played on his lips, wearing the beige T-shirt he had been found in and backed by a beautiful summer sky. Koppelman emailed the image to Nelson, who posted it on social media and sent it to the local news. Almost immediately, a staffer at an area homeless shelter called. She thought she recognized the man from her shelter. She also remembered his T-shirt. Nelson and her colleagues were able to track down medical records for the man, compare how they matched the body found in the river, and confirm the man's identity. The deceased had a name, Donald Nyden, and he was 68. The medical examiner's office broke the news to Nyden's family in Virginia, and the police were able to investigate, finding no foul play. In the online communities that track the missing and the dead, Koppelman's efforts were cheered. Rest in peace, Donald. And Carl, once again, amazing work. But Koppelman, a tall, barrel-chested man with a reserved manner and a perfectionist streak, could only see where he'd gone wrong. He had kind of a gaunt face, but I depicted him with a little more flesh on his face, he remembers. Koppelman took note of all the nuances he had yet to master and vowed to do better on drowning victims in the future. And there would be future victims of all kinds, because the nameless dead present an uneven, unending river of tragedy for American families and law enforcement. Those victims haunt Koppelman, who stores the disturbing details of each case inside his prodigious memory. The bones and tattered clothing of a 1980s Oklahoma murder victim, the inscription on a watch belonging to a John Doe from 2001. He has thrown himself into hundreds of cases, and, using his artistic abilities, aptitude with spreadsheets, and obsessive research skills, played a direct role in helping to solve at least 13 so far. Most of these cases are not like Donald Niden's. They creak on for years and may never be solved. Still, Koppelman persists, because the families are out there waiting and wondering. Death is one thing, Koppelman says, but dealing with a missing person in the family is entirely different. More than a decade of this volunteer work has taught him that the torment of never knowing what happened to a loved one is a special kind of hell. There are more items here, but we will read them from time to time. Now, finally, we have time for a few more items from my friend in Canada, little bits of wisdom. Some call it multitasking. I call it doing something else while I try to remember what I was doing in the first place. I don't understand why people have to get ready for bed. I'm always ready for bed. It's weird being the same age as old people. I told you, I do not have Alzheimer's. I have sometimers. Sometimes I remember, and sometimes I don't. And the last one here. Getting older is just one body part after another saying, ha ha, you think that's bad? Watch this. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to visit at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.